He's currently an adjunct professor at SMU in the same field. In addition, he holds a Master of Liberal Arts from SMU with a concentration in philosophy and serves as a board member of the Dallas Philosophers Forum. So we'll ask you to hold your questions till the end. We'll have a chance to engage Rob at the end. So without further ado, I give you Mr. Rob Olson.
These are the times that try men's souls. A simple quotation from Thomas Paine's The Crisis not only describes the beginning of the American Revolution, but also the life of Paine himself. Throughout most of his life, his writings inspired passion, but also brought him great criticism. He communicated the ideas of the Revolution to common farmers as easily as to intellectuals, creating prose that stirred the hearts of the American colonies. He had a grand vision for society. He was staunchly anti-slavery. He was one of the first to advocate a world peace organization. He advocated subsidized education for the needy, greater rights for women, and Social Security, a form of Social Security for the destitute and elderly. But his powerful and controversial views on religion would bring him many enemies. And by the end of his life, only a handful of people, actually six, attended his funeral. Yet he played a key role in two revolutions. The American Revolution of 1776, and the French Revolution of 1789. And he remains, after over two centuries, one of the most passionate advocates of man's rights to freedom, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But what were the seeds of his lasting greatness? He was born in Thetford, England in 1737. His parents were corset makers and Quakers. Of the town's roughly 2,000 inhabitants, just 31 white men of the right religion, were allowed to vote. This was at a time when wealthy, well-educated British men could vote three times. They could vote at their homes, they could vote at their offices, and they could vote at their universities. When George Washington ran for the House of Burgesses in the 1750s in the colonies, you had to own 50, white men could vote as long as you owned 50 acres of developed land or 25 acres of developed land or 50 acres of undeveloped land or a home. If you owned land that fit that criteria in several counties, then you could vote in 3, 4, or 5 counties. That's pretty amazing. But Paine would later ridicule the inequality of the British constitutional monarchy and arguing for universal male suffrage. His father's Quakerism played a pivotal role in his life. Quakers were seen as dissenters. They were seen as outsiders. They weren't allowed to vote, even if they held a lot of land. And Paine saw himself that same way. He saw himself as an outsider. He saw himself as a critical thinker. He saw himself as a dissenter. He was comfortable in that role of nonconformist, whether it was in politics or religion or anywhere where the established dogma ran counter to empirical scientific evidence. He also refused Latin lessons in grammar school on his father's orders, Latin being the official language of the throne and the popish altar. He concentrated instead on the English of Milton and Bunyan, and he excelled in Latin, in literature, science, mathematics. But he didn't spend a lot of time in school. He was basically self-taught. He was similar to George Washington in that respect. But a paradoxical reinforcement of this dissent came from compulsory Bible study at school, supplemented by Paine's Anglican mother. He was later to say that he found the teachings of Christianity, especially the human sacrifice, as repellent from the start. Young Thomas's first book for freedom came at the age of 16. He fled the confining apprenticeship of his father's corset-making business, and he made his way to the east coast of England, where he followed the immemorial tradition by trying to go to sea. I say he tried to go to sea because his father caught him at the last minute of the war and said, you can't go. This is not right. Later writings of stirring fiction for boys might have hesitated to invent a ship called the Terrible, commanded by a certain Captain William Death. I'm not making this up. D-E-A-T-H, Captain William Death. But such was the vessel, and such was the master and commander. Paine's father, as I mentioned, arrived and talked him out of it, and just like Ben Franklin's father had talked him out of doing the same thing many years prior to that. but this was indeed propitious for history. The fate of Catherine, death, and the terrible should come as no surprise to anyone. It's saying it went up against the French privateer, the Vengeance. So I guess you know, you name your ships, you know, it's a horrible, terrible sounding names and scares the opponent or something. Captain Death died in that battle, and most of the officers and most of the crewmen as well. So if his father hadn't intervened, I may not be making this speech today. But he headed seaward again after 3 years. The 7 years war between the British and French empires had begun, and then he got signed on by the Captain Mendez and the good ship King of Prussia. But he wasted no time in realizing he wasn't meant to be a military man. At that time, when you fought these battles, yeah, they were fighting the French, they won the battle, then they would get the booty from that ship. And then they had to share a certain percentage of the crown, a large percentage of the crown. But it was like kind of like a privateering kind of thing. It was semi-piratical, basically. But he realized it wasn't for him, and so he went to London to try to improve himself. We can trace his influence on the London scene of the young Paine. A new class of literary artists were coming about, much influenced by the thirst for knowledge and scientific innovations of the period. And so Paine enthusiastically participated in the Working Man's Lecture and the Freethinkers Tavern. Some of them were in taverns, some of them were in restaurants like ours, similar to our group, where there were rowdy discussion groups with the yeast for self-improvement and political reform. The next 20 years were trying times for Thomas Paine. He struggled and failed at a number of jobs, including corset making, excise officer, teacher, store clerk, union leader, lay preacher, and author for hire. He eventually failed at all of those. He tried his hand at marriage, and that didn't work out as well. One wife dying in childbirth along with the baby, and the other marriage ending mysteriously divorced after a short period of time. He lived off and on in London in various smaller coastal towns, but he was constantly involved in these debating clubs. Science, philosophy, religion, mathematics, you name it, he was involved in it. And his second trip to London was to be a very decisive one in his life, because that's where he renewed an acquaintance with one of his old lecturers who knew Benjamin Franklin, a man who personified the alliance between scientific inquiry and free thought. Franklin, a representative of the American colonies, took a big interest in Paine and found that the two had a great deal in common. Both men were self-educated. Both men were brought up in middle-class houses, the son of humble tradesmen. Both men bought the idea of serving as an apprentice in their father's shop. And both men tried to ship out on a privateer, as I mentioned, only to be talked out of it on the wharf by their concerned fathers. But ultimately, both did find their fortunes far from their place of birth. He gave Paine advice, which is advice we've heard of all of our lives. Go west, young man. He went further and gave him two letters of introduction, including one to his son-in-law, a Philadelphia merchant. So in 1774, he left on a very, very difficult voyage to America, to the colonies. It took about 2 or 3 months, I believe. And when he arrived at the port, after several months, he was almost lost to history by an outbreak of either typhus or scurvy on board. Most accounts say it's typhus. All aboard were quarantined, but his letters from Dr. Franklin gave him special treatment. He was allowed to be carried ashore in a stretcher and eventually recovered, of course. His 3,000-mile trip had taken him from a stale, hidebound world where a man's birth dictated the scope of his life to a new land where a man could go as far as ambition, hard work, and genius could take him. He had returned with, the change would profoundly alter the course of Thomas Paine's life. He in return would profoundly alter the future of his adopted homeland. So he found himself in Philadelphia, capital of the state and known as the capital of the New World, been founded by the Quaker William Penn. At a time when the leading cities of Europe were marred by poor sanitary conditions that had improved little since medieval times, Philadelphia had residential garbage removal and a regular street cleaning service. That was a big deal back then. Not very many cities had that in the colonies at that time. But it was by far the most cosmopolitan city in the colonies, with a steady stream of European visitors and immigrants. A rich cultural schedule of plays, music, art exhibits, political dissent, all sorts of political discussions, great bookstores, and many tavern-based or coffee-based discussion groups. So Pate very quickly met a bookstore proprietor who was hoping to start a new publication, the Pennsylvania Journal, and he asked Payne to take on the managing directorship, or editorship. And under his strong editorial leadership, the paper soon became one of the leading ones in Philadelphia. And he used at this time a number of pseudonyms to produce a stream of articles. He denunciated the slave trade, which maintained an open market of human beings in Philadelphia. He wrote that it was so surprising that he had all these Christians that were saying we were enslaved by England, and yet they themselves enslaved other human beings. He became a member of the American Anti-Slavery Society. He was also perhaps the first to endorse a system of welfare for the young and pensions for the old, unique at the time. In fact, Social Security Administration, they had a little part in their website, a little history, and they referenced Thomas Paine being the first one that advocated a pension to Social Security. He even prefigured the future American Constitution in his call for a charter based on the Magna Carta that would codify rights and laws instead of a representative Congress. But he saved his sharpest quills for the subject increasingly closest to his heart. The fundamental corruption, venality, and tyranny of the English system of government. This argument he used in part to advocate independence from Britain. No one else was advocating that at that time. A very unpopular sentiment among the colonists. He later had a falling out with his sponsor for drinking too much and left the journal. But he was now free to unmask his batteries, his Pope batteries, and to produce the largest achievement in the history of pamphleteering. The 46-page pamphlet, Common Sense, was indeed a catalyst that altered the course of American history. The pamphlet itself was the most important and most effective medium of political advocacy in America during the 18th century. To be sure, there's newspapers and there was almanacs, but it was the pamphlet that really caught hold, and people could pass it on from one to another, to another, to another. They could read it to each other. If it didn't wear out right away, it was shared between so many different people, friends and relatives, over great distances sometimes. But the pamphlet had a better chance of carrying a lasting impact. And none had a bigger impact than Common Sense, arguably America's first bestseller, which spread like wildfire among the colonies. At the beginning of Common Sense, Paine announced the target of his argument, stating that, quote, a long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right. He was telling his audience that he would not be trying to sway their minds one way or another on constitutional law or the details of the colonial charters that had preoccupied the debate at that time. He was signaling his intention of focusing on a totally different approach. The first assumption he would attempt to dispel was perhaps the most deeply held. The view that individual and collective rights are established and derived from governmental laws. They could be preserved only by governmental institutions. He immediately challenged that concept. He wanted his audience to view this issue with fresh eyes. He focused on the existence of natural laws governing the operation of all phenomena, including politics. The idea of natural laws was introduced by the ancient Greeks. These can be described as laws whose content is set by nature, that applies to everyone, and it's inherent within us as human beings. It's the same for all. It refers to these eternal laws that direct our actions as rational beings, and laws that are built into the very structure of the universe and fiber of our species. Morality could be known by reason alone, without revelation from God and governments, so that the whole human race could know how to live properly. So Paine would define natural rights, perhaps, as those rights of acting as an individual for his own, and for his own comfort and happiness, which are not injurious to the natural rights of others. As classically used, natural law refers to the use of reason to analyze nature and deduce binding rules on moral behavior. The idea remains alive today, particularly in jurisprudence. Natural law theories are opposed to legal positivism, the view that only the only binding laws are those imposed by human sovereigns, who cannot be subject to a higher legal restraint. So he argued for natural laws, these inherent laws part of the universe, as juxtaposed to positive laws that are created by man and by legislatures. St. Thomas Aquinas wrote a lot about natural law. He believed that natural law had a divine providence. If man-made laws, in his opinion, deflected from the laws of nature, it's a perversion of the law. And Paine held the same position. Paine argued that these older natural laws should be preeminent to civil laws, preeminent to the laws of George III. Preeminent, and this is based on a part by William Blackstone, he wrote about this great deal. By asserting the preeminence of natural laws, he had in effect nullified the strongest aspects of his opponent's argument in just the first few pages of his pamphlet. He wanted to knock off these governmental institutions off their privileged perch as the origins of civil rights. They didn't develop these rights. These rights were inherent from God or from the universe. It forced England to defend its record vis-a-vis the people's natural rights. He argued from nature. Paine argued from nature as the first source of human and natural rights. Knowing that many of his readers were farmers, he drew analogies to nature, saying that this was seed time, and that it was be folly to miss it. He also argued that the natural order would favor independence, and that it was absurd for a continent to be ruled, to be governed by an island. It was only common sense that a continent govern itself. This is King George III here. Paine would be one of the first to aim stinging barbs and devastating accusations against the king. And his ultimate goal was to attack the cement and the cohesion that held the two groups together. But he basically he wanted to overturn the prevailing tenets of the modern Tory position that the colonists' rights were rooted in the ancient constitution and that their interests were protected by the traditional connection. Great Britain. Paine said that there may have been a time when America's dependence on England was justified, beneficial. But that time has long passed. Hastened not only by English tyranny, led by George III, but also by America's growing maturity as a nation and as a people. Well, we may as well believe that because a child has thrived upon milk, that it is never to have meat. Only after the distinction between government versus society and civil rights versus natural rights were fully delineated could the formidable evidence in favor of independence take root. So he was building his argument step by step by step. By insisting that people's rights were natural rights conferred not only by governments but by the Creator, Paine set the context for his criticism of how America's rights and privileges were not being protected by Parliament. This new perspective meant that instead of the colonies having to defend their rights, it was Britain who had to defend its record protecting and preserving these rights on behalf of its subjects. By shifting the underlying premise of the debate in this way and putting the Tory position for the first time on the defensive, Paine was free to move on to the offensive. So he next focused on the concept of hereditary rule. In one of his more famous comments on the absurdity of hereditary rule, he observed that since the ability to govern was rarely passed down from one generation to another, neither should the right to govern be passed down from parent to child. Nature itself mocked the practice, he suggested, by so often giving mankind an ass or a lion. For England, the king and the House of Lords, because they were both hereditary, represented their own interests, obviously, rather than that of the people. It was therefore only the House of Commons on whose virtue depends the freedom of England. But Paine basically said, this is an illusion. This balance of power is an illusion. The king can override the House of Commons anytime he likes. The House of Lords can override the House of Commons anytime they desire. He ripped apart the idea of hereditary rule from the very beginning. Quote, though the people might initially say, we choose you for our head, They could not without manifest injustice to their children say that your children and your children's children shall reign over ours forever. Because such an unwise, unjust, unnatural compact might, in the next succession, put them under the government of a rogue or a fool. It is one of those evils which, when once established, is not easily removed. Many submit from fear, others from superstition, and the more powerful part shares with the king the plunder of the rest. Unquote. Payne next speculates on the origin of hereditary rule. Regarding the present race of the kings of the world, where did they come from? How did they come about to be in this power? We should find the first of them nothing better than the principal ruffian of some restless gang, quote, whose savage manners and preeminence obtained him the title of chief among plunderers. Yet his electors could have no idea of giving hereditary right to his defendants, to his descendants, because such a perpetual exclusion of themselves was incompatible with the free and restrained principles they professed to live by. Wherefore, hereditary succession in the early ages of monarchy could not take place as a matter of claim, but as something casual. But as few or no records were extant in those days. It was very easy, after the lapse of a few generations, to trump up some superstitious tale conveniently timed to cram hereditary rights down the throats of the vulgar. What at first was submitted to as a convenience was afterwards claimed as a right. In common sense, Payne narrowed the scope of his indictment from the general principle of hereditary rule to the English monarch, to King George III in person. The real villain, common sense, who he described as the sullen-tempered Pharaoh of England. And as I mentioned, those colonists at this time had more enmity toward Parliament than King George III. American writers had spared the king from much of their criticism. They criticized the royal charters, they criticized some of the royal governors that were in the colonies, they criticized Parliament, they criticized the House of Lords, they criticized the House of Commons. They did not criticize George III until Thomas Paine came around. He insisted that the king's conduct toward the colonies was a perversion of the expected conduct toward its children, because oftentimes the English presented the king as the father of the colonies, the father of the people that lived in the colonies. Paine disputed that, citing the bloodshed at Lexington and Concord to condemn, quote, the wretch that with the pretended title of father of his people can unfeelingly hear of their slaughter and composedly sleep with their blood upon his soul. The effect was startling and sudden in the colonies. The king's arms were removed from their place of honor in homes, in public buildings, and publicly burnt by patriotic mobs. Outside Boston, General George Washington, he always had the habit of toasting the king just before supper. That ended after common sense spread. Statues of the king were demolished throughout the colonies. Before common sense, the colonists had long believed that they could throw off the authority of Parliament while maintaining the traditional ties of loyalty to the monarch. Well, England didn't see it that way, and the king certainly didn't see it that way. From the British perspective, the British government was a trinity, one entity with three parts. House of Lords, House of Commons, all of that together was the crown. Common sense was written in part to convince its readers of the necessity and of the justice in taking the next fatal step to oppose not just the tyranny, but to oppose the tyrant. Quote, indeed we have it in our power to begin the world over again. After spending the bulk of common sense systematically undoing the mass of superstition and prejudice that prevented Americans from seeking independence, Payne explored some of the benefits that would result from the separation. First, the idea that America benefited from the protection of the British military was backward, Payne argued. The colonies had involved in many, many wars over the past century, from King William's War to the French and Indian War, and those were basically extensions of larger European wars. British was always fighting somebody, So America was drawn into all these battles, and Paine saw the ridiculousness of that, and that how that really weakened the colonies. And he was right, because America, after the Revolutionary War, America did not find itself at war with another European nation except for England until the dawn of the 20th century. In addition to the usual evils of war, Paine pointed out the devastating impact of these frequent wars on America's potential as a player, a key player in international commerce. Paine was a big believer, along with Jefferson, Madison, and Adams, in commerce. Paine said, quote, whenever war breaks out between England and any foreign power, the trade of America goes to ruin because of her connection to England. And that American trade would continue to suffer as long as it was a colony of England and always drawn into English wars. To those who granted all these points and yet counseled patience and restraint, Paine warned they were shirking their duties and leaving the burden to their children. He said that if it must come to war, quote, for God's sake, let it come to us as a final separation and not leave the next generation, our children, to be cutting throats. He had a way of working words. Paine's prose at times reached the lyrical power of poetry when describing the stakes in success or failure of the ongoing conflict. He used simple but powerful language and imagery to evoke a cause for far greater than taxes, tariffs, and parliamentary overreach. Quote, the sun never shined in a cause of greater worth. 'Tis not the affair of a city, a county, a province, or a kingdom, but of a continent, of at least one-eighth part of the habitable world. 'Tis not the concern of a day, a year, or an age. Posterity is virtually involved in the contest, and will be more or less affected even to the end of time by the proceedings now. Now is the seed time of continental union, faith, and honor. These passages in which Paine spoke like a prophet of manifest destiny, 50 years before the Monroe Doctrine was written, stand as the most striking lines in the pamphlet, and indeed, arguably in all the literature of the Revolutionary period. Common Sense was about 46 pages long, quite short, published anonymously, but signed by an Englishman, but the word got out fairly quickly who was the author. But it sold 500,000 copies in the course of the Revolution, with the colonies at a population of 3 million, with an addition even in German. As most of you know, literacy was not really common in the colonies at that time. Within 2 years, it was estimated that there was one copy per 5 residents, or basically one copy per household, of Common Sense. With nearly perfect pitch, Paine had caught the tone of voice that many people actually used while transforming his earthly appeal to a style that rose to the inspirational. It was a nice combination of the lay preacher with the rationalist. Yet there is much speculation that Benjamin Franklin or John Adams wrote the pamphlet. So easily understandable and yet commanding was the style of Common Sense, so suited to the time and need of the people that most had a hard time believing it came from such an unheralded, unexpected figure. Even after his authorship was revealed, rumors persisted for years that the pamphlet was written by one of the leading members of Congress, Thomas Jefferson here. After Common Sense was spreading far and wide, Jefferson returned to Philadelphia after some absence. He marveled at the changes in the city and the changes in the mood that people had concerning the English, concerning the king. He was amazed. It was obvious that he read and approved of Common Sense. Then, in Common Sense, Paine suggested that the Continental Congress formulate a manifesto describing the many miseries America had faced because of the British. Such a document, he argued, should, quote, forthrightly declare that not being able any longer to live happily or safely under the cruel disposition of the British court, we have been driven to the necessity of breaking off all connection with her. First time that was ever intended. On June 11, 1976, come on here, let's go. Yeah, a couple of centuries. Congress created a committee to draft a Declaration of Independence, and it fell to Jefferson, heavily influenced by the Englishmen, to bring it into execution. This declaration marked a formal departure on the part of the Continental Congress from all previous actions. Before, they were fighting, they were arguing that we need representation. Never any talk about independence from England. But this declaration indeed adopted that. And to justify the action, Jefferson put forth a radical new view of the nature of government and of the Anglo-American conflict. It was a view the American people had recently seen on the pages of Common Sense. First and foremost, Jefferson's preamble made clear that the ensuing declaration was in no way grounded upon the points of law in the British Constitution, any royal charters, any proclamations from any royal governors. It was appealing once again to the timeless, universal authority of the laws of nature and of nature's God. Other aspects of the declaration contained many of the same points launched so effectively in Common Sense. In fact, there was a paragraph in there denouncing the slave trade. Congress had that cut out before the document was approved and published. Less than a month after July 4th, 1776, Payne joined the Continental Army as an aide-de-camp to General Nathanael Greene, one of Washington's top generals. Shouldering a musket and sharing the hardships of Washington's men, the 39-year-old Payne marched with them during the dismal New York campaign and retreat across New Jersey. He spent his evenings in General Greene's tent hunched over a drumhead that he used as a writing table to pen his next great pamphlet, series of pamphlets called The American Crisis. Determined to rally the flagging volunteers and instill morale by recruiting fresh troops, the beginning of the pamphlet, written and published during the midst of a very, very, very cold winter, began as arguably one of the greatest inspiring war campfire orations ever. Quote, "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquerable. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness only that gives everything its value." Once again, the reception and the sale were extraordinary, and they had the effect of bringing more men to Washington's colors. The general ordered the crisis to be read to the assembled soldiers, many of whom who were illiterate, many of them who were demoralized, had it read at the battlefield campfires. Quote, "Not a man lives on the continent but fully believes that a separation of America from England must take place. And a generous parent should have said, if there must be war, let it be in my day that my child may have peace." These inspirational words were a rallying cry to the colony soldiers, generals, and citizens alike. Behind a little bit on my slides there. With the foundation of the American Republic well begun, Payne's thoughts returned to the old world and the idea, first expressed in Common Sense, that the principles of the American Revolution might spread to the entrenched monarchies of Europe. Quote, "Where liberty is not, there is my home," Payne once told Benjamin Franklin. Indeed, the U.S. was not home to Payne, but just a symbol for him. So he returned to Europe, 1787, and arrived at a time when Europe was pregnant with revolutionary ideas and radical promise. Although already famous throughout the continent as the author of Common Sense, he would soon rise to a prominence almost as great as he enjoyed in America during the war. Today, a man like Thomas Paine might be described as a public intellectual, as someone who spent his life writing and criticizing his society. And he said, "There is but one kind of life I am fit for, and that is a thinking one, and that is a writing one." But it goes to the heart of how he was different from Jefferson and Adams and Madison. He wrote for the common man. Our founding fathers, they wrote for fellow intellects. A And they were not social critics. Writing was just one of their many duties. Payne's task was very different for them. Some of this was different, and it was revealed in the various kinds of audiences that they had. The Founding Fathers, as I mentioned, their writing was very stylized. Rhetorical rules, filled with Latin quotations, references to Cicero, Horace, Rousseau, Locke, Aristotle, flowery writing. Common man couldn't understand that, so Payne said. Payne's writing was very different. He was not speaking to a nation of philosophers, but a nation of farmers. He was determined to reach a wider audience and to express feelings, revulsions, and visions that the typical conventions of writing would not allow. Payne looked for readers everywhere, but especially in the tavern and artisan-centered worlds of the cities. So he relied on his readers, knowing at least the Bible and the Book of Common Prayer. But he scorned words of sound, but his critics said he used barnyard imagery, and it wasn't right. It wasn't right for gentlemen of that era. Quote, as it is my design to make those that can scarcely read understand, I shall therefore avoid every literary ornament and put it in language as plain as the alphabet. He aimed to break through the usual niceties to reach people with a simple style. But he got into quite a bit of trouble because so many of the authorities said, if you want to, like in England, if you want to write these books, write them in very, very fine editions that the common man can't afford. So that the classic readers who read these fine, hardbound books, will handle it coolly. Payne, of course, ignored the British. And he was charged with sedition for writing The Rights of Man. In it, Payne spoke of the deep anger shared by many common men, people, artisans, shop owners, traders, petty merchants, who were tired of being scorned by the monarchical and aristocratic lord. So The Rights of Man was written in defense of the early French Revolution and was the first of two great pamphlets written in Europe, with the second being The Age of Reason. And The Rights of Man was another immediate bestseller. The purpose was to marry the ideas of the American and French Revolution and disseminate the ideas in Britain. But the published history of this book is interesting because it shows how fragile the right to dissent was. He was in trouble immediately after it was written. There was threats that he would be arrested by William Pitt's political police. But the pamphlet called for the spreading of the French Revolution across mainland Europe. So English Prime Minister William Pitt issued a royal proclamation aimed at vicious and seditious writing. And he summons to appear in court to Payne. But Payne exhibited great hubris as usual and made fun of King George, referred to him as his Majesty. He wanted to scare him out of the country. Pitt wanted to scare him out of the country, and he did so. Payne fleeing to France, where he was granted French citizenship and served on the French Constitution. But there was a great revolution going on then, as we know. The Jacobins proposed the execution of Louis XVI, pictured here. But Payne had reservations. He thought that the king should not be executed and thought there should be a trial. He was also opposed to the death penalty. This decision almost cost Payne his life because it made the more radical ones made Payne seem faint-hearted and weak and not a true supporter of the revolution. Back in England, the crown was bringing forth and advocating rallies in England inspired to oppose Payne's work. And Payne's effigy was publicly incinerated. Teachers, bookstore owners, small printers, and local advocates of free expression found themselves subject to fines, closures, and imprisonment. The Reign of Terror in France in 1793 and 1794, also known as the Terror, was a period of horrible violence that occurred after the onset of the French Revolution. It was incited by the conflict between rival political factions, the Girondins and the Jacobins, and marked by mass executions, maybe as many as 40,000. The guillotine, also called the National Razor, became the symbol of a string of executions. Louis XVI Marie Antoinette, pictured here, the Girondins, and many others lost their lives under its blade. It was actually seen, though. The Guillotine was seen as humane because the headsman sometimes missed on the first or second or third blow. So this was seen, the Guillotine was seen as humane, hard to believe. The law that states that revolutions devour their own children is apparently an inevitable one. Payne was arrested in France on Christmas Day, 1793, and was seen as not only being faint-hearted in his support of the revolution, but a foreigner as well. Demands for his head increased, and his was about to roll when a macabre accident occurred. His day of execution came up, but the chalk mark was placed at the wrong cell, and he survived. 4 days later, Robespierre was himself sent to the guillotine. With the immediate threat removed and the arrival in Paris of a new and more sympathetic ambassador, which was future President James Monroe, Paine's release was assured. Paine's remaining years in France gave the impression of a sour aftermath of a love affair. He was not trusted to leave the country. He went on to criticize France for its abolition of universal male suffrage. But he found that he was on the more of the conservative side of the argument and debate, whereas in America he was on the more liberal side, more radical side of the debate. The Rights of Man was written in response to Edmund Burke, pictured here. Edmund Burke was a fan of aristocracy. He felt like the aristocracy and the natural order, the kings, the crown, helped make societal stability and cohesion due to man's corrupt, base nature. Paine attacked this use of the phrase forever. Burke talked about forever, the crown, the hereditary rulers, stability, providing this forever. Quote from Paine, there never will be, and never can exist a parliament possessed of the right or the power to the end of time. Every age and generation must be free to act for itself, in all cases, as the ages and generations which precede. Paine argued that Burke was saying that, you know, that Burke contended that the authority of the dead was greater than the rights of the living. And Paine was saying, let not the dead rule the living. Thus, to Paine, all hereditary titles and honors were a mere human superimposition on the natural quality and natural rights of mankind. Quote, I have always considered monarchy to be a silly, contemptible thing. I compare it to something kept behind a curtain, about which there is a great deal of bustle and fuss, and a wonderful air of seeming solemnity. But when by any accident the curtain happens to open, and the company sees what it is, they burst into laughter. Author Frank Baum was one day to make himself immortal by recasting this insight for children in The Wizard of Oz. Paine said, the titles are but nicknames, and every nickname is a title. When I was a child, I thought as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. He also argued that with the monarchy, there was all this interbreeding and overbreeding. The rules of primogeniture required that no more than one son or heir be born in case of the need for a spare. Well, society's going to have to support those spares, that surplus. We're often underachievers. Paine drew a sharp distinction of monarchy and heredity to the newly minted United States. He related the figure of Washington as a man who had surrendered his commission as a general to the Continental Congress and was then a private citizen. He surrendered his commission. He took off his hat as an act of submission to Congress and later declined the idea of a king, no matter how hard Hamilton argued for that. In Rights of Man, Paine writes that war and conquest in Europe is futile, since the ruin of one country will inevitably help to bankrupt one's own. So let's back up a minute now, and switch gears, and discuss the publishing history of the Age of Reason. It is interesting to note that Thomas Paine, the victim of the terror, did not become paralyzed by brandy and despair. Instead, he wrote the last of his great works. The background of this pamphlet is even more interesting than the series of risks and chances that attended the birth of the Rights of Man. In In the spring of 1793, feeling himself increasingly threatened by the approach of Robespierre's police and expecting to be arrested at any minute, he sat down in his damp lodgings to write an account by candlelight and under fear and darkness of his attitudes toward religion, without a Bible. He dared not venture out. He wrote part one, but later expanded the pamphlet just before he was arrested. The Age of Reason, in a sense, is the counterpart and completion of the rights of man. This pamphlet would often destroy Paine's American reputation, and its drafting would offer a profound insight into the author's very character. If there's any moment in his life that reveals Paine as the Enlightenment's most adequate evangelist, it is this. For example, what kind of man, with dozens of friends either imprisoned or dead by the guillotine or by their own hand, with his own life directly imperiled, and expecting at any moment the knock on the door and the presentation of the warrant for his death sentence, just what kind of man would write a book under such horrendous conditions and call it The Age of Reason? Beyond its worship of God-given human reason, the Enlightenment fostered a religion, deism, that combined Aristotle, Epicurus, Cicero, and Newton, and was widely embraced by such luminaries as Edward Gibbon, Adam Smith, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Deism is the view that true religion is a natural religion. Most deists would dismiss revealed religion as a fiction. God wants his creatures to be happy and has ordained virtues as a means to it. But since God's benevolence is disinterested, he will ensure the knowledge for the deist. He will ensure the knowledge for happiness is universally acceptable. So salvation cannot depend on special revelation. True religion is an expression of a universal human nature whose essence is reason and is uniform in all times and all places. Religious traditions such as Christianity and Islam originate pain in naivete, political tyranny, and priestcraft, his term for witchcraft, which corrupt reason and overlay natural religion with impurities. In fact, many deists have suggested that Socrates, Jesus, the Buddha, Muhammad were each attempting to return his society's corrupt religion back to its original state, the state of deism. In Paine's mind, the ultimate chord of appeal is reason. By the late 18th century, it also meant an absentee God who creates the world, ordains its laws, and leaves it to its own devices. After creation, God leaves the world alone. That solves for many the philosophical problem of evil. But deism was a common belief among public men in that era. With the exception of John Adams, the first five American presidents were likely deists, who took great care never to refer publicly to a specific deity or to a particular religion. The most politically astute of that generation, Franklin, Washington, Jefferson, avoided discussing religion. At the same time, though, many of these people, though they considered the church reprehensible in many ways, they worried that if the common man was not schooled in church, they did not believe in Jesus, did not believe in a heaven, did not believe in a hell, and the rewards of heaven and the perils of hell, that they would become as immoral as apes. So even though they didn't believe in Jesus or the Christian religion or any of these revealed religions, they felt it was best for society that the common man believe in them for social stability purposes. But Paine didn't write to the intellectuals. He wrote once again to the farmers, to the artisans, to the craftsmen. In his pamphlet, he set to expose the crimes and horrors of the Old Testament, as well as the foolishness of the New Testament, as part of a vindication of God. No grand and noble deed, he asserted, should have such atrocities and stupidities laid to his charge. Many who never read The Age of Reason, including Theodore Roosevelt, would unjustly brand Paine as a filthy little atheist, when in fact Paine relentlessly attacked godlessness in his essay. Like most deists, Paine believed that losing faith in God could extinguish human compassion, could extinguish selflessness, morality, ethics, virtue, and grace, turning society into nothing but a gathering of beasts. These beliefs were framed at the very start of this seminal work. Quote, I believe in one God, and no more, and hope for happiness beyond this life. I believe in the equality of man, and I believe that religious duties consist in doing justice, loving mercy, and endeavoring to make our fellow creatures happy. But, lest it should be supposed that I believe in many other things in addition to these, I shall, in the progress of this work, declare the things I do not believe and my reasons for not believing them. I do not believe in the creed professed by the Jewish Church, by the Roman Church, by the Greek Church, by the Protestant Church, nor by any church. My own mind is my own church. Payne goes on to say that all national institutions of churches, whether Jewish, Christian, or Turkish, appear no more than human inventions set to terrify and enslave mankind and monopolize power and profit. Quote, of all the tyrannies that affect mankind, tyranny in religion is the worst. As usual, Payne's writing is well organized. One section builds upon another. He next argues against second-hand revelation and third and fourth-hand accounts. Quote, when I'm told that the Quran was written in heaven and brought to Muhammad by an angel, the account comes too near the same kind of hearsay evidence and second-hand authority as that seen in Christianity. I did not see the angel myself, and therefore I have a right not to believe it. Quote, when also I'm told that a woman called the Virgin Mary said that she was with child without cohabitation with a man, and that her betrothed husband Joseph said that an angel told him so, I have a right to believe them or not. Such a circumstance required a much stronger evidence than their very word for, but we don't even have this. For neither Joseph nor Mary wrote any such matters themselves. It is only reported by others that they said so. It is hearsay upon hearsay, and I do not choose to rest my belief upon such evidence. Payne goes on to say that the Bible represents Satan in the shape of an animal of the creation, defeating all the power and wisdom of the Almighty. The devil triumphed and the Almighty fell. This story represents God as capricious and insecure, as a person, as a capricious and insecure person, whose plans can be undone by one of the lowest of his creation, and who fashions humans only in order to torment and worry them. In Payne's view, this story is very derogatory to God. He would later say, belief in a cruel God makes a cruel man. Payne then demonstrates by means of mathematical computations and genealogical graphs of Jesus that either all four of the apostles were liars, or else they were quarreling very damningly among themselves. At none of the crucial points can they make their stories agree, whether it's the crucifixion or the ascension into heaven. And it was plain that they were not themselves witnesses to anything they purported to describe. He next questions Jesus as Lord God. Jesus, in his mind, Jesus was the Son of God in like manner that everyone here, everyone in creation, is the Father of all. Jesus is the Son just like we are all the sons. Jesus founded no new system. He called men to the practice of moral virtues and the belief of one God. The great trait in his character, according to Payne, is philanthropy. The church has set up a religion of pomp and of revenue, quote, in pretended imitation of a person whose life was humility and poverty. When Payne was 7 or 8 years of age, he heard a sermon about the crucifixion. Quote, I revolted at the recollection of what I heard and thought to myself that it was making God act like a passionate man that killed his son when he could not revenge himself in any other way. And I was sure a man would be hanged that did such a thing. I could not see for what purpose they preached such sermons. I felt that God was too good to do such an action, and also too almighty to be under any necessity doing it. I believe that any system or religion that has anything in it that shocks the mind of a child cannot be a true system. He talked about how it was not only a horrible sermon, but it was way, way too long and way too pompous. Which reminds me of a quote. I got this thanks to Jim Mathis. Jim Mathis provides a list of quotations every day. Rich is seeing. George Burns quote. Quote, the secret of a good sermon is to have a good beginning and have a good ending and having the two as close together as possible. Perhaps this is the first time Thomas Paine and George Burns were ever juxtaposed in a speech. He goes on to argue that the Christian, I'm talking about Paine, not George Burns. Paine goes on to argue that the Christian story of God the Father putting his son to death or employing people to do it in order to make mankind happier and better sets a poor example. As if man could be improved by the example of murder. Quote, how different is this to the pure and simple profession of deism? The true deist has but one deity, and his religion consists in contemplating the power, wisdom, and benignity of the deity in his works. Paine believed that human language is local and changeable, and therefore incapable of being used as a means of unchangeable and universal information. The idea that God sent Jesus Christ to publish, as they say, the glad tidings to all nations is consistent only with the ignorance of those who knew nothing of the world at that time. So he goes on and on to reject these revelations from the Bible. But then he asks the following question. But some perhaps will say, are we to have no word of God? No revelation? I answer yes. There is a word of God. There is a revelation. The word of God is the creation we behold. And it is in this word, which no human invention can counterfeit or alter, that God speaketh universally to man, independently of human nature. It is only in the creation that all of our ideas and conceptions of the word of God unite. It is an ever-existing original, which every man can read. It cannot be forged. It cannot be lost. It cannot be suppressed. It does not depend upon the will of man whether it shall be published or not. It publishes itself from one end of the earth to the other. It preaches to all nations and to all worlds. Do we want to contemplate God's power? We see it in the immensity of the creation. Do we want to contemplate God's wisdom? We see it in the unchangeable order by which the incomprehensible whole is governed. And finally, do we want to know what God is? Search not the book called the Scripture, which any human hand might make, but the Scripture called creation. Age of Reason marks almost the first time that frank contempt for organized religion was openly expressed. He attacked politically these churches that preach that the masses should accept what they have, even though they live in near starvation. They accepted and that God will care for them. He rejected that argument totally. He felt like that science and countries, governments, should help these and overcome these problems. It is perhaps a testimony to the state of affairs in France at that date that Paine did not even have access to a Bible. But he knew it well enough by heart to write the book. And then eventually taken in by James Monroe, who supplied him a Bible. But it is arresting to think of a book that began by candlelight, by a hunted dissident, then updated from memory in a death cell, and finally completed in the home of a distinguished future president of the United States. In 1802, he returned to America at the request of Jefferson. Latter years of Thomas Paine were sad. He was isolated and alienated many of his old friends. Just before he came back to America, well, in the last year or so of Washington's second term, he wrote him a scathing letter denunciating Washington for not helping him get him out of prison in the French terror. Washington never responded. So Payne responded by writing a 70-page letter to Washington and a 70-page letter to all the press in America, just ripping George Washington apart. Scathing denunciation that Washington was on the wrong mark here and the wrong mark there, that he was taking on the trappings of the office, that he provided no help in the French Revolution. That letter made him very unpopular. And he also sacrificed many former comrades by his publication of The Age of Reason. Even Benjamin Rush, shown here, one of his companions in the early days in Philadelphia, refused to speak to him because of the godless writings, his godless writings. Samuel Adams, another former friend, was very angry at Payne for his writings opposed to Christianity. Payne's personality was also a factor. For example, he was prickly, whereas Benjamin Franklin was charming. There was also something direct and earthy about Payne. He wore no mask over his fiery black eyes. His appearance was careless and slovenly. He was never quite able to shred his lowly corset-making origins and the effects of all those years living in poverty and obscurity in England. No wonder people said he was better in print than in the flesh. But he continued to write as he found much fault with early 19th century America. He was very upset about what was happening to the Native American Indians and saw that the theft of their land and the threat of their existence came largely from proselytizing Christianity, which used as a hypocritical cover for greed. He saw the U.S. as a superpower for liberty and democracy, and wasn't playing that part. He was very upset with Thomas Jefferson for allowing the continual importation of slaves into the new territories. In the long run, of course, this meant an expansion of the number of slave states as opposed to a free one. Payne tried to get Jefferson to change his mind, urging him to the point where Jefferson really didn't want to talk to him anymore. But the sugar and cotton interests triumphed in that debate. Payne's closing years, pitiful as they were, contained what many humanists would say is one closing triumph. Back in those days, it was believed by the devout that an unbeliever would scream for a priest when they were on their deathbed, that they would get a revelation that there was a God. So the death mask of Payne. Dying in ulcerated agony, he was imposed upon by two Presbyterian ministers who pushed past his housekeeper and urged him to avoid damnation by accepting Jesus Christ. Quote, "Let me have none of your popish stuff," Payne is reported to have responded, and he died, probably of old age, 72 years after his birth. Only six people, including two black freedmen, attended his funeral. Some historians argue that Payne made more noise in this war and excited more attention than such well-known European contemporaries as Adam Smith, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Voltaire, Kant, and Burke. His important works, Common Sense, The Rights of Man, The Age of Reason, became the three most widely read political and religious tracts of the 18th century. Payne's bold and courageous rejection of tyranny and injustice is as far-reaching as that of his dynamic 19th century. His powerful writings combine practical proposals, breathtaking vision, a humble respect and concern for the ordinary man, and a sober recognition of the complexity of human affairs. Throughout history, some books have changed the world. They have transformed the way we see ourselves and each other. They have inspired debate, dissent, war, and revolution. They have enriched lives, and they have destroyed lives. Such is the case of the pamphlets and essays of Thomas Paine, whose works and ideas have shook civilizations and helped make us who we are.
And there's a question. Yes, Ed.
I found the opening of your talk saying something I have not known about. That's quite recorded.
Uh-huh. His father, yeah.
Do you know more about that? What was the aims of his father, the Quakers that he associated with, and what was their impact on him?
The Quakers were very much pacifists. I think Dixon was a Quaker. And the Quakers were very, very much opposed to any authority other than the authority of God. They felt like these wars that were brought on by the popes and by the kings and all these conflicts, that they didn't want any part of it. They would only want part of what they deemed to be a religious war, which they really, I mean, they were very much pacifists. So he was very much influenced by that, but the Quakers were very much dissenters. And his father was a stalwart Quaker. His mother was an Anglican, so he had sort of, there was a mixture there of the Quaker and the Anglican. But, the Quakers were very much opposed to capital punishment. Paine was very much opposed to capital punishment, and that almost lost him his life when he came to Louis XVI. So that's a good question, Ed. I don't have a lot more detail on it than that, but he was very much influenced by his father's Quaker beliefs.
Well, at that time, there were a great number of Quakers who came to the United States.
Right. William Paine being one.
Yeah. And did he associate with other Quakers?
Yeah, he did. There was
from England.
Yeah. He did somewhat, but primarily that Quaker was interested in science, and interested in mathematics, and philosophy, and religion. Then he would associate with them, and he would talk to them. But he was such an intellectual that if there were Quakers in that group, then that's, he would talk to them, obviously. But what he was most, who he associated the most with would be the people that were interested in these ideas. So he was very much a scientist as well, and engineering. He proposed one of the very first iron bridges. That were out there, and so he was he along with Benjamin Franklin, they spent hours together talking about the science and all that. But as far as being part of any Quaker groups in America, I don't believe that he was. I didn't read about that.
I just want to hear any of his Quaker
friends. Yeah, I don't know of any particular ones. I mean, most of the ones, I didn't read about any of his friends in the columns of the Quakers.
Yes,
I was just really fascinated by his decision to use common language and to get it printed, and how different that was than the norm.
Right.
And the norm must have been really difficult.
It's hard to read. I don't know.
Harsh.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, John Adams wrote something similar to what Paine was writing later on. And I've read some, it's very, very difficult to read. I mean, it's so flowery. And he'll spend 10 sentences, and Paine would spend 2 sentences saying the same thing. But they oftentimes they wrote just to impress themselves on this stuff. And it was very, very flowery. But Paine, and he didn't have a formal education either. I mean, he had some schooling, but he was like Washington. He was a self-educated man. Both George Washington and Thomas Paine had a little bit of an inferiority complex because they weren't well educated. A lot of the politicians and generals that they dealt with in the colonies were graduates of Harvard and Yale. And so that was the type of writing they did. But Paine felt like that he wanted to write to the common man, and all those flowery niceties, he threw them out. But I mean, if you read Paine compared to Adams and some of the others, Jefferson, Paine's very, very easy to read. Very, very easy to understand. Very, very accessible. Yeah.
Okay. My question, I'm interested in how the migrant values was, I mean, I wasn't even familiar with how much of that really came through Paine. But anyway, how those are going to morph in the globalized world we're heading into, the capital flowing information and the huge changes. I'm also interested in whether the Universal Declaration of Human Rights has any, if there's any direct connection or if that work came through there.
Yeah, because that's based on natural law.
Okay.
The law of nature. That applies to everyone at the same time. And I can't remember if it's in that document or another document. Basically, it says that if there are laws that are passed by man that are unjust, laws that counter natural law, then they're perversions of the law and really no true law whatsoever. whatsoever. But, and the concept of natural law is built into the Declaration of Independence as well.
Follow up to the question on his writing style. I wonder, was there anything that's known of the influence that Benjamin Franklin had? I mean, Franklin had been written.
That's a very
good point. Poor Richard's Almanac, yeah,
exactly.
He's a publisher,
right.
He wrote to the masses.
Exactly, that's a great point, yeah.
So he might have been a great mentor.
Yeah, he was a great mentor. And I think if one were to ask Paine who his best friend was, it would be Benjamin Franklin. Because Benjamin Franklin did write to the common man as well. And short, pithy, you know, Paine used shorter sentences. Some of these sentences of some of the other founding fathers, you know, were 15, 20, 25 words long. You know, just the opposite of what Benjamin Franklin would do. And Paine would write short sentences that were much more easily understandable. But yeah, he was very much influenced by Franklin, and Franklin's letters of introduction helped Paine, helped get Paine where he was at in the colonies. Yes.
I had a question. I wanted to know if there was research you found that figures like, well, especially Paine and his writings, have been mythologized, maybe? That the tendency toward yep. historical fact is lost sometimes in an effort to
right.
paint a certain way.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, I had some sources that said that Paine's, that maybe the common sense, it was well read, but that a lot of the revolutionaries at the time, including George Washington and others, were talking independence before Thomas Paine. But it seemed like the majority of the books that I read on this, and I read quite a few, pointed to the fact that Paine's work was very, very influential. But not all historians agree on that. And some say that Paine's stature is represented greater than what it actually was. Then also, you know, when you read a biography on someone, my experience is that writer sort of kind of almost falls in love with his subject, you know, and gets enamored with him, and tends to go after those quotes and those sections that make that person look even greater. And so there may be some of that. There's a couple of stories I've read that stated that Paine certainly didn't belong as a founding father, and that maybe his role was romanticized and understated. So that's a good point. Yes.
Just based on your study of Paine, hypothetical question, had he not ever published The Age of Reason, what do you think his status would be as compared to our other founding fathers?
I think his status would have been much better, much higher. Yeah, I think the Age of Reason, that he had so many people turn against him. And even though it was not an atheist piece of work at all, but it was really picked apart Christianity, and the people that lived in the colonies at that time were primarily Christians, and they were threatened, and they did not like the fact that it was available to everyone, available to the common man. They really didn't like that aspect of it. So I mean, he was condemned a great deal. But for his letter to Washington, that 7-page letter to Washington. And the condemnation of Paine because of that letter only grew after Washington died in 1799. You know, because Washington became mythologized. And so, but I think those two, but primarily the Age of Reason, that really hurt Paine's legacy in America.
Am I correct in thinking that the financial aspect of his writing meant nothing to him, but in fact, didn't Benjamin Franklin even support him financially?
Yep. He did, yeah. He basically did not require royalties on his writings. He turned them down. He wanted to reduce the price of the books, of the pamphlets, so that more people could get them. And so he turned down those royalties. And he was living in poverty, and so it was George Washington that wrote a letter to Congress saying, we need to provide some money to Paine because he's in near poverty. He didn't get hardly any money at all from his writings. But yeah, he wasn't interested in money. He turned down so many royalties. He made some royalties off the rights of man, but common sense, he basically didn't make money off that at all. So that's another remarkable thing about it.
Didn't he Congress frame some property in New York State?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's where he was buried. They couldn't find a place to bury him. He died. It's an interesting story. He died. But prior to his death, he wanted to be buried in a Quaker cemetery, and they wouldn't do it. They would not allow that. He tried at a Presbyterian church at their cemetery, and they said no because of his diatribes, his writings against Christianity. And so Congress had donated some land to him in New Rochelle, New York. And when he died, he was buried there. But about 10 years later, his bones were dug up by an Englishman who was a big fan of his, taken back to the United States, and then eventually lost. Taken back to England, I'm sorry. Taken back to England.
Don't you know
to
take it back? Another question about the origin of the painting sacrifice. In my mind, perhaps because of the age of reason or anything else, I've always associated him with the Enlightenment, which was really, it had long forebears, but it really kind of came to its greatest flower just at the time of the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. I think the Enlightenment in terms of Smith and Hume and the intellectual center of Europe at that time, which was Edinburgh, Scotland. You mentioned that he was largely self-educated, he read a lot of stuff. Is there any documentation or any insight into who and what he was reading when, and whether The Rights of Man was in not only a new venture in writing, but might, to some degree, have been a new venture in thinking?
I believe so. That was a question that came up, and I read about 8 biographies on him, and tried to take the best of that into this speech. And there's really not any documentation as to what he read that I could find, as to what he actually read. Now, when you read his writings, then you can tell that he was very much influenced by Locke, by Cicero, who wrote about natural law, by Aquinas. So you have to infer based on what he wrote. Jefferson was very much influenced by Locke. And so I have to assume that Paine read a lot of the writers that you mentioned and was a big fan of Locke, but I did not find it anywhere, because I was fascinated with that. You know, who did he read? Who was he reading? But I think that's lost to history.
If I can comment, I'm reading some stuff about Adam Smith. Thomas Paine was acknowledged a big fan of his, one of his big supporters. Especially the moral sentiments, before the Wealth of Nations came out.
Right.
Because that was back in the 1750s.
Jackie? Yeah, I was just going to make a comment. Excuse me. You really need to read Paine himself. I mean, his writing, considering what Bob said about his being an autodidact and so forth. And, you know, we tend today not to want to read things that are very long, but the Age of Reason is totally a remarkable document. And considering the fact that, like the ledge of Jesus, like the historical timeline of when certain ideas actually appeared there out of sync, he did that all from here.
Memorization.
So
he didn't have a Bible when he wrote
so that. Don't take anybody's word for it. Okay, in this case, read what he wrote.
It speaks
for itself.
Well, on that note, we'll congratulate our speaker.